The problem is, you do see a lot of antisocial people succeed. Loneliness is as big a risk factor for ill health and death.
We live inside our heads.
You go cold turkey, you go into withdrawal.
There is a lot of value in the stuff that we struggle with.
Better Thinking, conversations with experts exploring all things psychology. Welcome back to Better Thinking. My name is Nesh Nikolic, and my guest today is Associate Professor Kelly Clemens, who is a senior lecturer in the School of Psychology in the Faculty of Science at UNSW. She has studied at the University of Otago and University of Sydney, with postdoctoral experience at the University of Bordeaux in France and Macquarie University before establishing her own laboratory at UNSW in 2012. She is here today to speak about all things addiction, including addiction neuroscience, modeling prenatal drug exposure, epigenetic consequences of drug addiction, and behavioral neuroscience of nicotine dependence. Absolutely fascinating conversation today. Kelly takes me through some of her latest research that is mind-blowing, and I think you're going to absolutely be surprised as well at some of the potential applications of what this research is looking at, and in actual fact, what some of the solutions to drug addiction, or at least mitigating factors that are available today. Enjoy. Kelly, a big thank you for coming onto the show today. It's really exciting to be able to talk about all things, addiction and drugs and the like. I think this is something that many of us feel that we're very well versed on. And unfortunately, that obviously means that we've probably got some blind spots. And so it's really lovely to be able to speak with you today and find out about, the most recent research and the like.
No, absolutely. Thank you for having me. And definitely keen to explore my research area with you.
Fantastic. Look, I always like to start with finding a little bit of the history, a little bit of the background of how you came into this research space. I find that there's always something interesting about that. So maybe I can hand over the mic to you and kind of ask, how did you find yourself in this world?
Yeah, so I grew up in New Zealand and I always wanted to be a vet and save animals and so forth. But in New Zealand, there's only one vet school. And my parents didn't think I'd get into it. In the end, I probably would have, but it just doesn't matter. So I ended up going to the University of Otago and studying zoology, which is as close as you can get to veterinary science. And as part of that, in my undergraduate, took a couple of courses in psychology. And I found the psychology aspect of it super interesting, learning all about Freud and then like visual perception. But I was particularly interested in neuroscience. So I particularly wanted to understand how the brain was working. So in parallel with my zoology, I also continued to take psychology and tried to merge those interests into neuroscience. So that gave me a really strong background and understanding of basic biological processes and concepts. I then did a master's in science at University of Otago, and that was starting to look into behavioral neuroscience and animal models of ADHD. And from then, I then came over to Australia and did a PhD. And that was where my journey with drug addiction started, because my supervisor was really interested in the interaction between ecstasy and methamphetamine, because these were two really popular drugs at the time, big party drugs, especially in Sydney, really dangerous. It was a time of the time when people were taking ecstasy and there were a couple of deaths related to it. So there was a lot of interest in party drugs at that time. That then continued on through my PhD and was followed by a postdoctoral fellowship in Bordeaux in France, where I started learning about nicotine. And initially I thought, compared to ecstasy and methamphetamine, nicotine is super boring. No one cares about smoking. But it turns out that from a neuroscience perspective, it's infinitely complex. And from a psychological perspective, more interesting, because even though nicotine, it's not a drug that gives you a big high and a euphoria and like, oh my God, that was the best cigarette ever, but it's one of the hardest drugs to quit. It's up there with heroin in terms of quit rates. So that sparked my interest in that area. There's a whole bunch of political and social elements to it as well, which I find fascinating. So when I first went to France, you could still smoke in restaurants and bars, which I found quite confronting. So there's a lot of elements about it that make it fascinating. So from then I came back to Australia, had a couple of kids, was at Macquarie University, and then ended up settling here at the University of New South Wales, which has been fantastic because UNSW is perhaps one of the strongest places, definitely in Australia, if not the world, to do the sort of research that I do.
Hmm. It's quite a journey, and it's interesting to hear your take on, you know, looking at, you know, ecstasy and methamphetamines versus nicotine. But what struck me in that is you talking about how nicotine is really difficult to you know, step away from.
Yeah.
And my mind immediately, I was trying to kind of formulate why would that be? And I know you mentioned, you know, maybe some political and social elements. I wonder if most people take ecstasy as example as a party drug. So it might only be several hours of a week or 2 weeks or several times a week. And I don't know what the average user might be in terms of frequency of ecstasy, but nicotine for many, at least previously, and certainly in Australia, not so much today with the significant bans of cigarettes, but and more recently the e-cigarettes, I forgot what they're called.
Vaping,
that's it, thank you. They're very, very social in nature. Like it's almost like going out and saying, is coffee the drug or is the social connection the drug? And maybe they're both together so strongly bonded and effective that there's something there, but maybe we can explore that as well. But it seems like nicotine might have such high connection with that social aspect that it adds on top of the actual dependence of the drug and withdrawals from it.
Yeah, so 100%. I mean, like, that's the thing with nicotine, it becomes more about the psychology than the pharmacology. So with, like, as a side note, what you're saying about ecstasy does tend to be something that people take irregularly on weekends and party situations, and generally people take it at a certain time of their life where it's consistent and conducive to enabling that sort of lifestyle where you can go out and have a big weekend and then go back to work. And so generally people's ecstasy use exists for about 2 years and then they naturally stop using ecstasy. Whereas for smoking, it is something, smoking and alcohol in particular, are the ones that can persist across a lifetime. And so amongst smokers, there's definitely people who are very heavy smokers and daily smokers. And then there's people that the Americans called chippers, which is like people that will smoke only in social situations. So I'm sure you have friends or colleagues who don't smoke really very much at all, but if they're out drinking, for example, will smoke while they're drinking. And that can be just as challenging to quit as someone who's a daily smoker. And the reason is because initially when people smoke, there's nicotine receptors in our brain that the nicotine binds to and creates some pleasurable feelings and a whole range of other things that contribute to smoking. But over time, that smoking occurs usually in very specific contexts, like you say, a social context. And so those feelings of, like, positive feelings of smoking become inextricably linked to that social context. And so then next time they go out into that same context, it reminds them of the smoking and initiates cravings and then initiates smoking again. So it's those associative processes, like really basic learning and memory processes, that form connections between smoking and the places or the people or the paraphernalia, you know, like seeing other people smoking, smelling smoking, that trigger this memory that is super strong and persists for a really long time. So a lot of what we've been looking at is, how is it possible that a smoking memory, like that contextual smoking memory, can form so rapidly and then persist for such a long period of time? Like my husband, for example, you know, he hasn't smoked probably for 15 years, but if he's watching a movie and there's someone smoking, he'll still experience cravings. And that's incredible that that can happen over such a long period of time.
It's so interesting because it jumps out at me in terms of I'm always trying to explain things in my mind, so I'm making connections that probably aren't there. But it seems very familiar in the context of eating a nice meal. So many of us enjoy the meal much more if it's shared with someone that we care with, care for, than if it's alone. You know, we do tend to kind of say, "I'll try this little bit. That's quite nice." Or, you know, "Dip yours into my sauce. You've got to try this. It's really smoky."
Yeah.
And we have this kind of beautiful experience in comparison to having the same meal and the same flavors, but just doing it solo. There is something that almost accentuates the enjoy and highlights the flavors and the whole experience by sharing it. And it seems that maybe, you know, all of these enjoyable life experiences, when they're shared or added with a cigarette, they become accentuated and stick more. I know that I can't remember who it was, but I had someone on the podcast talking about, from a therapy point of view, the importance of spending time with a client on their wins, on what they did well, on how they did problem solve, how they overcame a problem, and encouraging spending time celebrating, so to speak, so that it would, from a behavioral perspective, stick. It would become much more powerful. Similarly, how if we have high emotion in a post-traumatic stress scenario, if we have high emotion in a success scenario, we're more likely to remember it. It's going to be sticky. I wonder if that might be a factor that's in play as well.
Sorry, I don't know. I think that it differs depending on different drugs of abuse. And I think that often when we talk about drug addiction, it's portrayed as, you know, people talk about the war on drugs, for example, and particularly in North America, the war on drugs is, you know, us versus them, and that drugs falls under this umbrella term that encompasses everything, encompasses smoking, drinking, heroin, all of it, right? That they're drugs and they're all bad and we should wage a war against them. But each of them has very unique profiles, the way they work in the brain. There's some consistent elements that also overlap with things like compulsive gambling disorder and compulsive overeating, but there's very distinct differences between the different drugs of abuse as well. So in terms of what you're talking about, in terms of social elements, that also really comes down to what the drug's doing in the first place. So ecstasy is a really pro-social drug because it works mostly on serotonin. And serotonin is, you know, the receptor and the neural system in our brain that is important for emotion, and when it's dysregulated leads to depression. So that's how ecstasy works. That's not how nicotine works. That's not how alcohol works. So they're depending on the drug and the different ways that they work would definitely interface with those social aspects in different ways. And the progression of drug addiction is also important. So the things that motivate you to take the drug in the first place will be quite different from the things that maintain that drug use later on, a year or 2 years down the track, and will be also quite different to the reasons why you would find quitting challenging, or the factors that will lead to relapse. So even though, you know, smoking might be, and alcohol is another really good one, because alcohol is inextricably linked to social dynamics and social anxiety. So you might start drinking early on in your life as a means of relaxing, but across time, it ends up being that you need to drink in order to socialize and in order to feel relaxed. So that balance tips. So something that's important early on might progress to something quite different later on if you continue use.
And what are some of the most correlated reasons of why, out of 100 people, a segment of that population continues to use versus others, as you say, for example, ecstasy remains at a 2-year experience on average, if I understood that correctly, or thereabouts. Yeah. It's kind of like a phase through life. Someone goes through a party scene at a younger age and they're using ecstasy with their friends, and then it kind of tapers off. What are some of the correlations or research findings there?
So there's a lot of people who are super interested in that exact question. Is there a way that we can predict who's vulnerable, who's going to struggle later on in life? You know, amongst, like you say, 100 people, we can drink socially, but there's some people that find it challenging, or some people try smoking and hate it and don't continue. So one of the really major factors that comes out in susceptibility to addiction is trauma. So any sort of childhood trauma, abuse, bullying, stress, all of these sorts of things are highly correlated with later vulnerability to abuse, to drug abuse. Obviously, social and socioeconomic factors also become a factor. There's a really interesting book, actually, or sort of, it's a bit controversial, but there's a book by this guy called Carl Hart called High Times. So Carl Hart is someone who grew up in a poor community in the States, I can't remember, like Florida or something like that. And he grew up in an environment where alcohol and crack cocaine use was very, very common. And often people, you know, their parents would be drug users, and so they would become drug users because that's what they were exposed to. But Carl himself was really good at basketball, and so he funneled a lot of his time and energy into basketball. And so he had an alternative to drug taking. So he kind of came up with this idea that has been put forward by other people as well, including a guy called Heyman, that that drug addiction arises through a lack of choice. So if you're living in an environment, particularly, you know, I'm in the eastern suburbs here of Sydney, there's so much opportunities for people to do things like go surfing, go swimming, there's heaps of parks and stuff like that. So if you have multiple options available to you that make you feel good, then you're less likely to engage in drug use. Whereas if you don't have other choices in your life that make you feel happy, if you don't have other things that can give you that natural high, then the drug use is there and it's an obvious option. And so his book is really interesting because it makes it changes the way that we think about drug addiction, and it's that it's an absence of choices rather than that it's a lack of willpower or something like that. So interestingly, some researchers using animal models followed up on this. And so a colleague of mine, Serge Ahmed, who's at the University of Bordeaux in France, he did this paradigm where he trained some rats to take cocaine. So rats love cocaine, just like humans do. He put them in a situation where he said, you can choose to have cocaine, or you can choose to have sucrose and or saccharin to take the calories out of it. So the rats were able to go into a box and like decide, am I going to have cocaine or am I going to have sucrose? And I think nearly everybody, like when I tell this story to my students, everyone goes, well, of course they're going to choose cocaine. Cocaine is so much more addictive than saccharin. All of the rats are going to love cocaine. But what actually happens is that the vast majority of the animals actually choose saccharin or sucrose. So when we're testing animals in an experimental paradigm and we're like, the only thing available to you is cocaine, of course they're going to take cocaine. But when you give them options and choices, then they actually, the like 90% of them will choose the saccharin or the sucrose over cocaine, over heroin, over methamphetamine, over nicotine, over everything else. And the next progression of that study was that people asked that same question about, do you choose cocaine or do you choose social interaction? So rats will get the option to choose between having an infusion of cocaine, intravenous cocaine, which they love, or a door being opened and them allowing to go and hang out with a friend. So in that social choice paradigm, again, the vast majority of the rats will go and choose to hang out with their friends and enjoy a social experience than taking cocaine. So there are some issues with these paradigms, but I think it's really revealing that given options and giving choices, the animals intrinsically will choose those over the drug of abuse. And when we apply that to what's happening in the world that we live in, you can see that if you're living in poverty or in a situation where you're unable to engage in like team sports or go to the beach or whatever, but someone's saying, here, have some methamphetamine, that's a much easier choice to make than someone who has a whole range of other positive experiences available to them.
And the choices are quite important, not only in terms of what they are, but the variety of choices, because not all of us would want social connection all the time. Sometimes it might be playing a sport that is not quite social but competitive. Others might be going out and playing on a playground, mastering some sort of skill. There might be an individual pursuit, for example, but just choice in general. Is that right?
Yeah, just other things. It might be like, you know, doing art. It might be doing music, other things that make you feel good. So having the capacity to have these other things available to you means that there's multiple opportunities within your day for you to feel good. Obviously, there's other benefits of exercise and stuff like that. But one of the characteristics of people that are really deep in drug addiction is it becomes very isolating, and it becomes that the social interaction drops away. And so that then exacerbates the issue. So they're not having those other rewarding experiences that make them feel better. It's you'd probably find the book really interesting, I would imagine.
Oh, absolutely. I think I'll be picking that one up. High Times by Carl Hart.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds not only from a hypothesis point of view, it sounds like Serge Ahmed's work, I think I got that right, I'm not sure, work goes out and demonstrates that. It's not 100%, but it's demonstrating that given choice of quite variation, and obviously starting with just two, whether it's sucrose and cocaine, the more that we provide other alternate choices, the more likely a rat's going to go out and select the alternatives, not only even from a probability point of view, right? I mean, just purely on probability, if you've got 100 items on offer, you're 1 in 100, at least statistically, going to go for cocaine. Let alone if the other ones are more compelling than cocaine, you might go with them. But truth be told, even if you do select cocaine, the likelihood is going to be statistically less often, because you've got other things that you want to have the other times. It's almost like potentially recreational use within the community. There are people who take cocaine in Australia who are incredibly functioning and great community members.
Yeah.
And forget about cocaine on any drugs.
Yeah.
Where that drug is just an item within a smorgasbord of things that they like to do. And many of those mean family and social things, contributing and work and exercise and so on. And one of them is smoking some marijuana.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's why during COVID, drug use increased substantially, because people were isolated. And so that social reward wasn't present in the same way. And so like alcohol use and those sorts of things increased. So the important thing is that the rats, the choice isn't mutually exclusive, so they can have both. And the other, perhaps more interesting element of it, that there is still, depending on the drug, some animals that will prefer cocaine. So there are definitely a small proportion that is, I think it's around 10% or something like that, that will continue to choose cocaine. So I think from our perspective and understanding how the brain works, those are the ones that we want to look at and try and understand, because I think it's around, you know, 10 to 17% of humans that try different drugs of abuse will end up like continuing their use. And so the proportion is a bit similar. So, you know, now Serge's work and other people have obviously picked this up, really interested in understanding what that small proportion, what's different about how their brains work, what's different about the way that they're processing information around drug use and the way that their brain is responding to it. And so, as I said at the start, like in humans, definitely Trauma is a big factor in the persistence of drug use. And the way I like to think about it is that drug use or compulsive gambling or compulsive overeating or, you know, any of those things is a band-aid solution to try and escape, you know, the other stuff that's going on. So it's just to treat addiction, we need to understand both of those things in combination.
Can you help me with defining a little bit about what trauma means? I have this a little bit of a psychological problem with the word trauma just because of concept creep. It seems to be that trauma is starting to become a catch-all where it's referred to sometimes as something very significant, like, you know, major physical assault, you know, could be, you know, sexual assault, you know, violence within the home, and so on. And there's other traumas also which seem to be in the milder category, so to speak, and acknowledging that it can be in the severe category as well. And I'm not sure how research goes out and figures out whether it's mild, moderate, or severe. But let's say, for example, bullying. I know that most kids understand the term bullying, and based on that, a lot of people would say, I have experienced bullying. Yet the definition of bullying needs to be that it's persistent and that it's targeted, etc. But we don't use it in that term very much. And in self-report questionnaires, it might more so just say, have you experienced bullying? So many people just go tick, you know, that might actually be almost, you know, have you experienced teasing? And most kids at school have experienced teasing. But can you talk me through a little bit about how trauma is connected? And, you know, this is a sticky point for me, so I always get caught up on this.
So just as a full disclosure, I'm not an expert in trauma and stuff like that. Cool. But the way that I think about it is that it's all relative. So if you think about the significant trauma that you describe through, you know, like physical assault, for that person is obviously can be enormously traumatic, but it depends on your past history, how you deal with it. But on the other hand, you know, a trauma could be that during your childhood, specific comments were made about the way that you looked, and you latch onto that comment and it dictates everything that follows. So then that can also be a traumatic experience that can significantly alter your mental health trajectory. So it's a really challenging thing, because I think it's easy to go, well, this person got beat up, but this person got told that they had funny ears or something. And you're like, well, obviously, that's different. But to that person, their personal experience of that and the consequences of that could be quite similar. Do you see what I mean? So sure. I think it's very, very hard to quantify, and it's such trauma, is such a personal experience, and the consequences of it and how that person deals with it are very, very different. So, but we do know that trauma and stress, and or stress that comes about because of trauma, can change the way your brain works, and it can change the way that your brain works in such a manner that means that when you experience or encounter drugs of abuse, the way that they're working and the impact they're having on your brain is different to somebody who hasn't perhaps had that past experience. But definitely there's literature showing that, you know, particularly if we use the more significant trauma, because perhaps, like you say, it's easier to identify and it's easier to define, then that is definitely a predictor for later drug use in some people. But there's so many mitigating factors, you know, like the family unit, the support. But, you know, addiction is a very, very complex disorder. There's no one single fix for any one individual, because for any one person it's so different. But there's definitely a link there, and there's definitely evidence of changes to the brain and how the brain functions that predict, well, not predict, but are associated with later susceptibility to addiction.
Look, that's helpful, because it if the definition were perceived or experienced stress to an unwanted experience, at least there's a common understanding as to what that means. And so it doesn't say there's a cutoff threshold.
Yeah.
It helps to say that drug addiction is correlated with perceived stress levels. And so we can still go and say, well, what mitigates that? You know, an example might be a child that feels like they are being targeted in the playground. If they have parents that then approach the school, they might feel like they're being supported, as an example, which will mitigate the perceived stress that they are having because they've got support on their side.
Yeah,
if they don't have those social elements or friends that will step in for them, for the exact same experience, the exact same type of bullying or teasing, they might have a much higher level of stress experienced.
Yeah.
And on the outside, the objective would be it looks exactly the same because you'd see the exact same scenario occurring, but what's occurring on the inside and cortisol levels and et cetera is more based on how the not only the perceived in that moment, but ongoing, whether they do have actual support around them, where the place, where, whether the classroom is safe or the playground is safe or not. So if you're going into a playground consistently that does not feel safe, that's not a good way to develop.
Yeah, absolutely. And then it just has like all these follow-on effects. So, you know, one of the things that you mentioned at the start, one of the areas of my research that we're really focusing on at the minute is the impact of prenatal drug exposure. Mm-hmm. And so if an infant is exposed to drugs of abuse in utero, that sets them up for this exact same sort of trajectory where if like it changes their brain in a way that means that when they encounter things like bullying, for example, the way that they're going to encode that information is very different. They're more at risk of mental health disorder, more at risk of ADHD, and all of these factors that change that trajectory. And I think that that's, you know, one of the, it can be something very minor or something quite significant that can just change the trajectory, and then that cascades and accumulates.
Can you talk me through a little bit about the literature and your work in the prenatal drug exposure? And maybe that also links in a little bit with epigenetic studies around, you know, I believe there might be particular ones out there where wars have occurred, or, you know, periods of hardship or whatever it might be, sort of in nations that can certainly say some things. And I know that someone is a Jablanka, I've read her material, I'll come to me a little bit later. She's done so much work on epigenetics. It's so fascinating. It'll come to me, but maybe you could just talk me through a little bit of that prenatal exposure, and that might overlap into some of the epigenetic studies that you're aware of too.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, those two things are inextricably, I've said inextricably three times now, but are really closely linked. And so I think epigenetics explains everything. But in the context of the opioid exposure, so, you know, I work mostly in animal models and, you know, looking at brains and sections under the microscope. And I had a student that wanted to work in the prenatal opioid area, and we started working with clinicians. And it really completely shifted my mindset in terms of making sure that the science that I'm doing has a purpose. And so I've been now a few times over to the hospital. So we work with the Royal Hospital for Women, over to the neonatal intensive care unit, and you walk into that unit, and, you know, there's a lot happening there, and there are infants there. So there was an infant there last time I was over who was born at 23 weeks, which is the earliest viable point at which babies can be born at the moment, and they can keep them alive. And so she was born to a mother who was had multiple drug dependencies, and including opioids. So what happens for that infant is when they're in the uterus of the mother, any drug that the mother is taking is passing immediately through to the baby. So there's no barrier that stops anything. So particularly in the States, opioid use disorder is massive at the minute. There's a bit of an epidemic here in Australia. It's probably more methamphetamine, but there's still exposure to opioids. So those babies are kind of bathed in these drugs. during pregnancy. And what happens is that then they're at risk of preterm labor. That often happens. And when they're born, they're immediately thrust into this acute stage of withdrawal. So, you know, you might have seen like in the movies or something, people going through opioid withdrawal as adults. That's what those infants are going to go through at the time when they're born, because the opioid exposure through their mother immediately stops. So the first line of treatment is then to put these infants onto something like methadone or morphine as a replacement therapy, and then wean them off of that drug as they grow. So the problem, though, is that we know that methadone, morphine, heroin, fentanyl, all these opioids have a quite profound effect on the neurodevelopment of the infant. So normally in your brain and in your body, you have opioid receptors that are really important as an adult for pain management and all of these sorts of things. But during early development, they're quite important for the development of the brain, and in particular, the development of myelin, or the white matter in the brain that is kind of like the insulation around the axons of the neurons that means that information can pass rapidly through your brain. So these opioid systems that are normally there to do their normal functioning are bathed in external opioids, and it leads to dysfunction and developmental delays in these infants. So then they're born, and the only way to keep them alive is to give them more opioids. So during these critical developmental periods, they're getting more opioids that they need to stay alive. There's no other options. Mm-hmm. They often end up also having antipsychotics and anti-seizure medication to keep them alive. So they are kept alive to this point, and then they get weaned off the morphine or the methadone, and then basically at the minute the system is that they go, you're good now, see you later. Off to live your life. But we know, you know, in conjunction with my colleague, Professor Julie Oy at the Royal Hospital for Women, that the trajectory of those infants is very different. So those kids perform worse at NAPLAN, at primary school and at high school. And that is even, you could go, oh, well, because of the socioeconomic factors, obviously that's going to contribute. Even when you account for that, and even when you take into account the fact that most of the infants are in foster care, it doesn't normalize that. So even when you take into account all of the other possible mitigating factors, they're still experiencing cognitive delays. There's some research now coming out, again from North America, where they show that up to 50% of these infants are diagnosed with a mental health disorder by the age of 5, which is pretty pretty striking, really. So these kids are born, they go through this intensive care to stay alive, and then once they are alive, they go off into the world and they struggle. And so, you know, Julie talks anecdotally about how most of these infants, as they grow, end up getting into trouble, and often the leading causes of death is premature death due to suicide or drug overdose. So these kids, even though they grow and they develop, where they end up is really different. And what we're really interested in is understanding, is there anything that we can do to help change that trajectory? So using our animal models, you know, you can kind of have the lifetime of a rat within 2 years versus, you know, 30 or 40 years in a human. So we can look at interventions. And one of the really interesting interventions that we've been looking at is the gut microbiome. So in human adult opioid use disorder, their gut bacteria is dysfunctional, and that has a whole range of implications, because it makes the gut a bit more leaky. It means that bad metabolites and toxins leak out into the bloodstream that normally wouldn't get there. Those toxins can travel through to the brain, and we know that opioids also make the blood-brain barrier more leaky. So those toxins can end up in the brain, cause inflammation and a whole range of other things. So we think that the same things are happening in the infants. And so we think by targeting the gut microbiome, we might be able to improve the trajectory of these infants even a little bit, which means that they're at least risk of all these cascade of events that ultimately happen.
What an awful and terrible start to some poor children's lives, where they're born to a parent that's obviously having incredible challenges themselves, and
absolutely
effectively born drug dependent,
yeah,
and needing to then maintain taking drugs to survive, that, you know, consequently and simultaneously keeps them alive, you know, is required, but destroys some of the developmental milestones or features that are really important in early life. And we know that, you know, early development is so important. And I had no idea that some of that development, you know, the mechanisms in which it can continue to be a factor through things like, you know, your gut biome being leaky and the like, that actually just makes it a lifelong problem. Yeah. Taking away the trauma, you know, and this is that trauma that I think objectively it doesn't even matter how a person goes out and measures this. We know that this is physical trauma. Yeah. This is going out and creating, you know, putting obviously drugs, pollutants into a young body, which changes all sorts of developmental things, let alone neglect and other things that are likely to be there, or, you know, the bonding problems of being in foster care and the like. Gosh, no wonder that obviously controlling on everything, the NAP plan is still showing that they're, you know, significantly lower. That just makes sense.
I think the shame of it, though, is that you've probably heard about fetal alcohol syndrome, right? You've probably heard that it's not good to drink during pregnancy, and those guys get a lot of funding to investigate that, and justifiably so, because it's definitely a contributing factor to many childhood developmental issues that is not recognised. Everybody knows you shouldn't smoke during pregnancy. That gets funding. People understand that. But these infants, the drug, like particularly the, I guess, like harder or more illicit drug exposure to them, not a lot of people care about it. And the reason why is because they go, well, I think generally the amongst the general public is that it's your own fault because it's a lack of self-control. If you really wanted to stop taking the drugs, you should. And if you're taking drugs during pregnancy, oh my God, how could you do that to your baby? But as you just indicated, those people are going through a really, really hard time. And so it's not a choice in that same way. And so raising awareness about these sorts of things and us being able to get funding to do this research, so we're looking at a dietary supplement that we could give to the infants that would significantly improve their outcomes. So in our rat model that hopefully we're going to publish really shortly, if I have rats that are exposed to methadone during the prenatal period, and then they grow up into adults, and we do these tests with them where they have to do tasks on a touch screen, basically an iPad. The ones that have had methadone exposure have real trouble solving the task, and part of it's a memory task. And so these are pups that had exposure, you know, during pregnancy, and then have grown up as adults drug-free, and then later on we can still pick up that deficit. But if we give them this dietary supplement, then that is completely reversed and they end up looking like the normal animals. So it could be, and this dietary supplement is something that I'm not going to say what it is because then everyone goes, oh, I should take that. But it's something that you can buy at the chemist, and it's super cheap and it's super safe. And it's something that is already, like, it's a metabolite of fiber, basically. So something so simple as that when those babies are identified and born, we go, here, add this into the formula, and it just improves that whole trajectory. Like, that would be amazing. And it would be something that can help one of the most vulnerable populations that we have, these infants that through absolute no fault of their own are born into this environment where they're already behind the eight ball. Like, they're already, their whole life, they're going to be running into a headwind. And so if there's even something as simple as basic dietary supplement that we could give them that would help even a little bit, it could have a profound effect on their trajectory. So we definitely, I think, as behavioral neuroscientists, you know, our clinicians are completely overworked. They have no time. We can come in and go, let's give you a hand with that. We'll do all the biology and all that sort of stuff. How about this? Let's try it. And our aim would be to take that to a clinical trial, because I think that it's such a simple answer to a very complex and really terrible problem.
Well, I think a lot of these things do have simple solutions when it's understood. You know, I think it's very obvious, for example, if we look around the world, that good nutrition means so much. You know, it's ridiculously powerful. You know, we take it for granted because it's like, well, you know, almost all Australians just eat well. They've got, you know, access to you know, a plethora of foods. We've got Woolworths and Coles and your local IGAs. So we don't have that concern in our mind. But the truth is there are certainly deficits that occur in these situations. You know, no different to sometimes we you know, research tells us, hey, give pregnant women folate. That's a really wise thing to do. Otherwise, X, Y, Z. And I don't even know what the X, Y, Z is. Someone's told me, but I've forgotten. It's fallen out of my memory stores. But we know that this is really important. And it's not just a particular folate. There's a specific one. And that's why they sell that on, you know, and every doctor will tell you, make sure you start this. You've found out that you're pregnant. Can I ask you, and obviously, you know, our audience understanding that this isn't yet proven. It's got to go still through trials, that this is early. I think we've got a reasonable understanding that this is a hypothesis. But can I ask what that simple thing is that's off the shelf without us saying we're prescribing anything by any stretch of the imagination?
So it's a short chain fatty acid, which is, it's called sodium butyrate that you buy it from the chemist, or it can be called butyric acid or butyrate. And basically when we eat fiber, the fiber is broken down into a whole bunch of these short chain fatty acids. There's about five or six of them. And those molecules are then really important for maintaining the integrity of the gut blood barrier and keeping the gut healthy. And in people that have poor diet, they possibly are having low levels of this, or in people that are sick or ill, like say, an example is like people who are having chemotherapy for cancer treatment, and it really messes up the gut, then the levels of these short chain fatty acids drops down. So the one that we picked up on was sodium butyrate, and it's really super interesting because sodium butyrate does about 15 things that almost identically complement the deficits caused by opioids. So where opioids impact myelination, sodium butyrate is being shown in a couple of studies to promote myelination. Where opioids increase inflammatory markers, the sodium butyrate reduces those. So it seems to be a particular match for sodium for methadone and for opioids. I don't think it'd work for methamphetamine, for example, because the way methamphetamine works is really different. But it just seems to be a really good match for the opioid stuff. And our data is really promising in that regard, in terms of the brain changes, the gut changes, and the behavioral changes. If you eat tons of fiber, you're going to have heaps of it anyway.
Yeah. And that's what's incredible is that obviously to use this in that type of population, the likelihood of high fiber is going to be quite low. I think it's probably low for a lot of us, sadly, even though it's readily available. But it is interesting that something so simple potentially has these remarkable effects, and that's no different to when we figured out that if we as a society work on our sanitary problem of, you know, getting rid of waste, or we improve things like diet, you know, in another part of our conversation we said, hey, choice is a really important part of the equation. Here we're saying for a particular type of condition and problem, something so as simple as sodium butyrate could be incredibly beneficial. Obviously still to be tested. But I do remember watching a podcast with, I think his name was Gary Brecker. And I don't know the validity of what he talks about, but I think he's a biologist that really spoke about the importance of your body being able to process particular types of food. And you can give the same food to a bunch of people, and for specific people, the way that they process this food can either be remarkably valuable to you in terms of giving you much greater energy and the like, or it can do quite the opposite, where you know it saps you of lots of energy, and it's difficult for you to process. Maybe this is the gut biome type of stuff that you're all over. But piecing those two things together, assuming what Gary's talking about is valid, I can see how this research talks about a similar type of thing. If you can go out and provide a particular nutrient that then helps with mitigating this other stuff, it could be as simple as that, at least to bolster the trajectory of you know, where it would have gone to something a little bit better. And you know, I don't think this is obviously the silver bullet, but how exciting.
Yeah, no, it's super cool. Like, and it's really, I like, often when we're doing research, we talk about translational potential, and it's, you know, like 10, 20 years down the track. Whereas with this, because it's already recognized as a safe drug, you know, it could be 5 years down the track. And I think that's super exciting. Another aspect of the sodium butyrate that is probably a bit of a segue into the epigenetic stuff is that sodium butyrate is also a drug that is an epigenetic regulator. So if, you know, epigenetics are basically you're born with DNA, and it's the blueprint for everything that makes you in your life, and like your body and all the proteins that make you up. But some of the genes are switched on and some of them are switched off. And epigenetics is kind of the way that those genes are switched on and off. So, for example, you don't want retinal cells in your eyes expressing hair follicles. That doesn't make sense. So the hair follicle genes are switched off and the retinal cell genes are switched on. So that makes sense. It's a way of organizing our DNA and making sure the right genes are expressed in the right way. And so sodium butyrate is a really interesting drug because it's an epigenetic regulator, and it can help switch on or off genes that are important for promoting health and memory and cognition, actually. So we know drugs of abuse, they lead to a whole range of epigenetic changes that can actually be really important for changing how your brain works. Like, you know, before we were saying how trauma can have a lifelong impact on later susceptibility. One of the mechanisms through that is that trauma turns on genes relating to stress and stress regulation. And then later on, when you experience drugs of abuse, how your brain reacts to that is different because these epigenetic marks are changed. So sodium butyrate is a drug that, when we're giving it to our infants, there's research to show that it can epigenetically regulate genes in the liver that are important for like the way that the liver responds to inflammation and an immune response. We also know that if I give my rats sodium butyrate, like I give them a task where I'm like, look at these two objects, and they look at them and they go, yeah, cool, I've got that. And then I give them sodium butyrate, and then I bring them back the next day and I change one of the objects so it's new. The rat normally will go, oh my God, that's a new object. And he'll remember that for about an hour, but he usually won't remember it for 24 hours. But if I give the rat sodium butyrate, then he'll remember it for 24 hours. And in fact, he'll remember it for 7 days. So sodium butyrate turns on genes that facilitate memory. So on top of all of that, like gut microbiome and all that sort of stuff, we've also got the impact of sodium butyrate on this turning good genes on, basically, to help support the individual. So we're still trying to unpack that a little bit in the context of the prenatal opioid work, but it's also possible that sodium butyrate is also having all of these other more peripheral effects, which is making the immune system stronger, reducing the inflammatory response to later like insults and bacterial infections, and possibly also promoting like good memory genes in the brain. So all together, it's actually having like quite a global positive effect, at least in an animal model.
And what brought you to investigating sodium butyrate in particular? What was the methodology? I know it doesn't happen overnight, and you're not just kind of randomly closing your eyes and, you know, pointing at different substances and introducing them. What brought about that as a point of interest?
So as with all things, basically, it was a bit of good luck. So I think as scientists, we need to always be open to circumstance and serendipity. So we had been using sodium butyrate, particularly for its epigenetic effects. So I was quite interested in, you know, when earlier on I was saying, you know, smokers, they form these memories and with the context in which they smoke, and that memory can persist for a really, really long time. That memory persists even when, like, structural changes in your brain go back to normal, your nicotine receptors go back to normal. There's no evidence that you're a smoker in your brain, but that memory still persists. And we were quite interested in epigenetics being a mechanism through which enables that memory to persist. So it kind of sets things up and changes the brain in a way that that memory about smoking is enabled to last for a very long time. So we were using sodium butyrate in the lab as a means of kind of interrogating that relationship. And we've since gone on and done a whole bunch of other work that's also quite exciting and hopefully leading to some pretty cool gene therapeutic stuff. But it was something we were using in the lab, and I knew it had these pro-cognitive effects. And so I thought, well, in our animal model of prenatal opioids, these animals have cognitive deficits. Is it possible that a drug like sodium butyrate could reverse those cognitive deficits? And we started looking in the literature, and just everything was matching up, which never happens. So like the myelination, there's evidence it does remyelination, and then the inflammation and all these sorts of things that just started like adding up, which is really weird. And so that's why we decided to go ahead with it. But it was simply because we'd been using it in the lab to kind of like, yeah, interrogate these epigenetic factors in drug addiction. We went, hang on a minute, that could work there. And it worked out on this occasion.
It's really fascinating to hear you talk, because in many ways, we've looked across the whole lifespan, you know, everything from, you know, prenatal and potentially even before that, right? Like to you know, grandparents and the like, yeah. When we start looking at epigenetics, all the way through to, you know, immediately after birth and what can be done quite early on, and, you know, and choice into adulthood and even what we could do on a social front in terms of giving, you know, the population more choice, more variety, more opportunity, so they can select accordingly, whether it's you know, from a social front or engaging in other activities. You know, drugs and alcohol or whatever mechanism that we look at it is obviously always going to be an item, a problem, a concern for those who continue to choose it. You know, like anything, you know, we can say the same thing with food. We can say the same thing with work.
Yeah.
You know, this is something that we can look at mitigating from, you know, before life, all the way through to at least before the life of future generations, through to, you know, those current. What an exciting time to be living.
Yeah, and drug addiction is always going to be an issue, and, you know, there's reasons why people end up using drugs of abuse, and often those aren't good reasons in terms of, you know, like these infants being born into this situation where they're more likely to use drugs themselves, and it's really through no fault of their own. So I'm sure, like, you're probably familiar with the drug policy in Portugal, where they're trying to, like, you know, decriminalize drug use, and to some extent that makes it a mental health disorder rather than a criminal issue. And I really feel like that's the way that we've got to go if we want to make any headway with addiction.
Look, I'm so excited by that when I found out about that through Johan Hari's sort of talk in TED and the Rat Park and the like, I wrote to our local minister and federal minister and sent them information and other bits saying, you know, let's review this, let's have a look at this. Obviously, I didn't get a response or an answer, but that doesn't matter. I can see the value in this. And I suppose one of the questions that raises is, I know that you're on the research front, but do you get pushback to the work that you do? Do you hear, like, you know, the rejection of these ideas? You know, because some of these things are on the surface simple. Mm-hmm. Obviously, what Portugal is doing is very complicated and sophisticated and difficult from a political front as well. You know, yeah. You've got to convince a nation or voters that your numbers are not going to go up of drug usage or abuse and you know, dependency and the problems that come with that by decriminalizing. And in actual fact, taking money away from law enforcement, moving funds from law enforcement, all of those to pro-social opportunities and activities and the like that have been shown to have a greater effect than putting them through the court system and the like. Have you had much to do in that space of how your work ends up landing, in on the road, so to speak, like how it ends up being used?
Yeah, so not a lot. I think that there are people in that area that do that much better than I would. I think that some of our work can be used sometimes to support those sorts of arguments, but probably, I don't know, my impression is that there's a lot of things going on and an issue that impacts a marginalized aspect of society probably isn't going to get much traction. But I think probably something that we all could do is, instead of being scared of people that have, you know, substance use disorders, is to have a little bit of empathy for them, because people don't choose to be drug addicts for no reason. People don't wake up in the morning and go, I'm going to become a heroin addict. It usually comes through a place of trauma, and so that person is not going to be in a good place to start with. So I think if we all can perhaps be a little bit more sympathetic and empathetic, then that might help. But I certainly know, particularly around the smoking stuff, people have very little empathy. It's the same with around obesity, and that people don't they see it as a lack of willpower and mental strength. So if you wanted to stop smoking, you could. And we know that that's not the case. The brain of a smoker is not the same as the brain of a non-smoker. The brain of a heroin user is not the same. And so it, particularly those drugs of abuse, affect, you know, the prefrontal cortex and the part of the brain that's making those decisions about stopping and trying to stop. And that part of the brain in particular is not the same. You know, we know that there's a whole range of epigenetic changes there, for example. And so I think if everyone could have a little bit more empathy and sympathy for people in these situations, that would go a long way to then enabling individuals to seek help. So I always think it's funny with mental health that, you know, if you have a broken leg, go to the doctor and everyone's sympathetic to you, can I give you a hand or something, you know, take my seat. But if you have a mental health disorder that is internal, there's very little sympathy for it because people struggle to understand. So those sorts of, I guess, broader societal changes, if they happen, then, and really the discussion around mental health more generally, then it'll have a flow-on effect for my research area.
It's interesting because for some, to be fair, it is true that if they want to stop smoking or whatever it is, they can. Unfortunately, we then extrapolate that to everybody, right? And the truth is, you could say that for anything. You know, if someone wants to be a fantastic athlete, they can. Well, yeah, that's usually for that small minority that goes to the gym, you know, six times a week. And good on them. And I think we should go out and applaud them and be inspired by them. There's another part of the population that I think we need to appreciate, and as you say, be sympathetic to and understanding and caring and nurturing, that despite their best efforts, and it could be because they're working very, very hard to raise a family and everything else that goes on, including trauma that's occurred in their past and ongoing, there are lots of challenges, and We don't go out and say just because one person can, then everyone should be able to do so. That is, you know, a ridiculous notion. It's unfounded, and we should go out and say, how do we support those that are in need? And you know, I think we're all marginalized at some level. We're not all fantastic and wonderful intellectually. You know, some struggle much more than others. Some are much more athletic. Some are much more social. You know, it's not hard to see the differences, individual differences that people have. And one of those things might be individual differences that come from also circumstance. You know, if I were born in a different, to a different family, not out of choice, but just out of random nature and probability and the like, I would develop differently. Even if I had my current genes, as you say, they'd be methylated in a different way. Yep. You know, maybe in vitro, I would have, you know, drugs in my system and the like, and then, you know, all the opportunities that may pass because of that I've been unbelievably blessed. And if we can use that word luck again as well, you know, those of us who are lucky, fortunate, we really should be looking after those who are, you know, having a harder time. That doesn't mean that we give them a free pass. It doesn't mean that we just go and say, oh, we're so compassionate, we don't ask you to do a single thing. Portugal does not do that. They don't just say, we just give and that's it, right? They incentivize, and they've got lots of complex and difficult social programs that are get buy-in from the people who are marginalized and having difficulties. Yeah. So it's complex, and it needs a lot of smart people on it, and compassionate people as well. But how fascinating, Kelly, to have this opportunity to talk to you. Your work is mind-blowing, phenomenal. I can't wait to see what the future brings, and I hope that these rat experiments can translate through to humans in this same way that folate has demonstrated itself, and many others, because I think once we're on that path, other researchers go, I've got a thought, we could do this, and it shows that easy, highly accessible things might be available that, you know, not only we can use in the Western world, imagine the entire world.
Yeah.
You know, that's the beauty of science, and that's the beauty of medicine.
Yeah.
I can't thank you enough for your contributions. I appreciate you immensely. And let me actually end with asking you, where can people find out more? There's going to be listeners who want to read up more. They want to find out more. Where could you point them to, you know, continue this conversation?
Yeah, so the paper with the prenatal opioids and the sodium butyrate, we're finalising that now, so keep an eye out for that in the next probably 3 to 6 months. We'll be getting that out. We're really fortunate to get a lot of funding this year from the NHMRC to continue on that project, which I think, yeah, keep an eye out. We'll be publishing a lot more. If they want to contact me directly, feel free to email me. If you Google my name at UNSW, I come up, there's a whole bunch of things there. Feel free to contact me through that route. I'm happy to talk about these things more. I really feel like that having more discussions about these sorts of things, and particularly the prenatal opioid exposure, because it also applies to prescription medicines, so people in pain management, the more we talk about it, the better it is. So I'm happy to discuss, and find me through the UNSW website, the School of Psychology.
Look, this is mind-blowing, because these type of findings often have many more benefits that are not understood yet, and many more to come. So I'm glad that more funding is coming your way. And I wish you the best also in not only publishing, but, you know, the dissemination of these ideas. The conversation is so important, and, you know, it's so humbling to speak with someone like yourself who's on that edge, looking at it and interested, so passionate. So it's beautiful to see your eyes light up when you do talk about these things. We're very fortunate, and thank you again, Kelly, for the taking the time. If you do publish, you're more than welcome to also soon. That is, you're more than welcome to give us a link to any of those, and we'll put that on our show notes so that our listeners can hear about that. It's March 2024, so if it's 6-9 months or whatever it might be, if we're able to get a copy of that, we'll add it to our show notes. But otherwise, I'm sure you can find it if you are looking for it. So thanks again, Kelly. I appreciate you and your work and your team as well. I'm sure this doesn't happen in a silo by yourself. So thank you. And I'd love to speak with you again at some point, as the research develops.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.